Thank you. Billy's got his watch up here for me. It's Phil Bowens, I'm an alcoholic. Thanks. Thanks for inviting me up here to talk again. Nice to see you. I'm going to share a little bit about my story and tell you, oh man, about the rough ride I had and how good life is now. And, so I'm in the third phase of my life now. The first phase of my life was the pre-drinking. That lasted about 18 years until I got a chance to go away from my mom and dad and start the second phase of my life, which is the drinking. That lasted another 15 years. And now I'm 9 years into the third phase of my life, and I hope it is going to be the final phase of my life. I can't go back to that drinking again. That was horrible. So my sobriety date is February 16th, 2002. I was 33 years old at the time, and I was at the end of my life. Looking back, I was a young man. Now some people come in earlier, some people come in later. But man, I wanted to push the reset button on life. And to know that life has gotten better since then, as a result of getting plugged into Alcoholics Anonymous, is why I want to talk to you guys tonight. If there's drunks out there, man, we have a real... something really to offer. First thing I needed to find out about myself was that I was a drunk. So that was that first step. That was that second phase of my life. We call the first step phase, when I realized that it wasn't working at all. I had a series of worst years of my life. And after a few of those, it became clear that every year was going to be the worst year of my life. It's got worse and worse and worse. I think I reached a pinnacle in my success. Finally, I passed that now in my new life, but in my old life, the peak of my success was at about 24, 25, 26 years old, something like that. By the time I was 33 and at the end of my rope, man, there was no way to getting back any close to that. I'd just been on a steeper and steeper and steeper decline. The acceleration of my demise was picking up. I was going down that hill. Steeper and steeper, and it's funny. I got accused of being a high bottom drunk. By the time I was sober, getting sober, becoming sober, what I had lost was, by that time, one relationship that was supposed to lead to marriage, as a result of my alcoholism, three residencies. I've become a physician and gotten kicked out of three residencies. I was unable to support myself, so I was living with my mom and dad, which is a form of homelessness. And I was one step away from I'd become addicted to a second drug. My drug was alcohol, but I found a solution in another drug called Ritalin, which is a prescription you get for having attention deficit disorder. Now I was a spacey person by that time. I got a diagnosed with adult attention deficit disorder because I had a deficit of attention. I'll tell you that. And I got addicted to that drug. I'd been able to stop drinking for actually 2 years before I got sober. I stopped drinking for an entire year doing that drug, and so I thought I wasn't an alcoholic. But by the time I actually at my bottom, I'm drinking again. When I lost that third residency and the married woman I was dating dumped me, I was probably about a week away from starting to inject that drug. I'd been snorting it for a long time, and I was about to take it to the next level. So when I think about what brought me to my bottom in 2002, I don't know that there was anything traumatic or dramatic that happened at that moment in time. So I'm steady. Decline. The slope wasn't too bad. It was kind of, each month is slightly worse than the previous, but nothing dramatic happened. But that's really what happened, that I was about to take my drug use to the next level. My dad had some, you know, insulin syringes in the house, and I had the pills, and I was thinking about crushing them up and starting to see what it would be like to shoot them up. And I think that's probably led to my... At some level, I wasn't conscious at all. I had to look back and figure out what was going on. And I was hopeless and helpless. And I needed to make a decision. I was going to get better. I was going to get worse. And So anyway, it didn't start out that way. Like I said, by the time I was 26, whatever. I doing well in life. First 18 years was like, you know, prepping for a successful life. Got a chance to go to a good school in college. I did well in college. Got a chance to go to medical school. During those 10 years when I was in college and medical school, I know you're doing the math. It's supposed to be 8 years, right? I did well. And, I got a chance to repeat my first year of medical school. That was my first real failure in life. I just remember I was in my mom and dad's house again, you know. And they'd seen me drinking the year before I went to medical school. I had to spend the summer with them. And they saw that the amount that I drank, and my mom found a bunch of vodka bottles in the bedroom closet. It was just horrible. And when I had to, a year later, come spend the summer with them again and just announce to the family, like it was a big crime that I'd committed, I said, tell your brother that you failed out of medical school. You have to repeat the first year. And it was like a punishment. And I just thought, that's so vindictive. That's so harsh of you but I see now what my father was trying to do was not so much put my face in it, but just make me realize that this was my doing. I was the one who dragged myself out of school, you know. So I knew that. What he didn't understand was that he was trying to project his non-alcoholic way of looking on the world on me. And so if he were me, he wouldn't think like that. If I were me, I had to drink like that. So he didn't understand that. Now, going back to my family, there's alcoholism all through my family. They wouldn't recognize. I am the first person in the history of generations who's, you know, officially an alcoholic, officially recovered alcoholic. It turns out, especially on my mother's side, but on my father's side too, well, on my mother's side, all the males are alcoholic, and there's alcoholism throughout my father's side too, but I never knew about any of this stuff, because I was hidden from this. But I think that's the family, every generation did that. A few years ago, my cousin died of Darvocet overdose. That's alcoholism. You know, but, you know, what does the family to this day say about that? No, the doctors were wrong to give him Darvocet. Well, doctors weren't wrong to give him Darvocet. He was wrong to go to many, many doctors and get Darvocet and overdose and die. Same thing happened throughout the generation. My father didn't die of alcoholism. He died from a car wreck. Yeah, go figure, right? And we went back to Pennsylvania, my mom and dad, and we get along fine now that I can make amends. And my mom showed me where she grew up. This is the one-room schoolhouse where I went. We sat in the bar where my grandfather used to drink, and that's the turn where he used to crash his car. You know, this is a pattern in my family. But I didn't know growing up that I was alcoholic. I knew that I was protected. I knew that my parents were overbearing, and they were overprotective. They were demanding, and they wasn't fair that an A minus is just not good enough in this house. You know, there was no thought of not going to college. You know, there's that. Now I know it's a bit of overcompensation. I had a lot of that myself. I need to do well in life to prove something that I didn't know what was going on. What do I have to prove? Why do I have this inferiority complex that I need to overcompensate for? Why do I have to feel better than you? And so if we're all equals, I had to get two majors in college, get two degrees in college, and then I was going to go to medical school and be a, you know, brain surgeon or whatever I was going to be, just to prove something, you know, just to feel good. I couldn't be the equal to anybody. I had to be better just to prove. Alcoholics talk about that all the time, but I had no understanding about why I had to be that way. What was the spiritual problem I had? I didn't have a spiritual problem with God. I outgrew God. That was no spiritual objection to it. I just finally realized that God was a bunch of nonsense that people who had some silly reason to believe in Santa Claus had to have in their lives, you know. So I was an intellectual, and I was an atheist, and I was a scientist, and I was it was horribly lonely, you know. And so I don't know why I drank. I know that when I drank, I had that phenomenon of craving happen instantly, and I always overshot the mark. And I know that very soon on in my drinking, when I was 18 and away at college, I started to have consequences, but they were manageable, and there were the costs of doing business, and, you know, making drunk dialing ass of myself, or throwing up on someone's laundry, or these are minor things. You know, I got in a fight one time, but that guy got in more trouble than I did, because he was drunk too, and he was, you know, things happen. And by the time I was, you know, ready to take it to the next level and go to, you know, medical school, I had managed, you know, got a chance to repeat that first year. Now I had managed for 4 years now to control my drinking. Now my idea of controlled drinking means find out how much it takes to pass the class, the bare minimum, and do just that much more. That is miserable. I barely remember that period of time. I drank, but I managed to, oh, I gotta fight this. I'm gonna wake up tomorrow. Let me put it down. Now, there were many, many times when I didn't wake up, but I managed to just find where the minimum is and do that amount. I was, remarkably, not even the bottom. I made a joke about this. You know, I was in the top 99% of my class when I graduated. That means 99% of us did better than that bottom 1%. I was not in that bottom 1%. I was in the bottom 10%, but I was in the top 99%. Just think about it. So I was not a very good student, and, you know. But that alcoholism was really a problem. By the time I, you know, chance to repeat that first year of medical school, and then graduate. Finally, okay, I'm going to put this aside, like I had done after college. I'm going to put this drinking aside and live. You know, and then the series of. First time I got labeled an alcoholic by someone who was, you know, like a dean or somebody like that was actually the second residency. So I grew up in Illinois, went to schools in Illinois, I went to residency in Illinois. I was supposed to do 3 years of a medicine program, and they said, fine, you've finished your 1 year internship, but you can't stay on for the 3 years, because let's go do find something else. So I moved from Illinois to Richmond. And I was the worst, right? I got kicked out of this program. But I found a place that accepted me. It was actually extremely competitive. And I got into the oncology program at Massey Cancer Center. And it's just like, this is perfect. All I have to do, please God, is don't drink. I knew this consciously. You know, no one had told me that. Later in the year was when someone officially told me I was alcoholic. But in my mind, I'm not going to drink. So I did really, really well. It was fantastic. The first 2 months, I'm getting 96%. I am like in a really competitive program. I'm doing really well. Man, life is great. And as Bill W. said, the goose hung high. I had to look up that phrase on Google to find out what the heck that meant. Man, everything was going great. You know, and so I maybe have a little bit to drink. I'm a big shot, you know. And so things, this is, I don't know, September or so of 1998. By April, they're telling me I'm an alcoholic. I'll get my months confused. But what I told them was, I cannot be an alcoholic because, I don't know how I phrased it to them, but there's a combination. What I said to them, what I was thinking at the time, but basically the message was, I can't be an alcoholic because I saw this coming and I stopped drinking 3 months ago. Therefore, I'm not alcoholic. And it made sense to me, and the argument somehow came out that I'm not alcoholic. And they were telling me things like, we really think you're capable of doing well. You're doing poorly. You're capable of doing well. We really like you. We want to keep you around. We can't have you stay in this program unless you admit that you have a problem. We think it's alcoholism. We want you to get help and see our program. And my answer was, I just told you I haven't had a drink for 3 months. I'm obviously not alcoholic, and therefore I don't need help. And they said, well, you obviously have a problem. If your problem isn't alcoholism, we suggest you find out what your problem is and fix it. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to stay. This is a 4-year program, and I'm finishing up with my first year of it. And that's how I got my Ritalin addiction. I had this bright idea. Well, I'm not able to focus on anything. I can't get anything done. I'm taking all my patient's charts that they need, because they're the patient's charts, and I put them in my desk because I can't finish them. I can't bring myself to get them anything done. And when they say, "Why aren't you getting anything done?" I would say, I'm paralyzed. I can't do anything. Well, this is all true, and it's all obviously alcoholism. Obvious to anybody. The guy that followed me around with a Lysol can, it wasn't because I stank because I didn't bathe. It's because I stank of alcohol. And I would say, "I didn't drink." And he said, "Well, what about last night?" I said, "Oh, yeah, but that's last night, you know." And it's very obvious to everybody I was alcoholic. So that was when I first got labeled an alcoholic. I found an addiction to the Ritalin that they gave me as a result of diagnosing myself ADD. So I didn't drink for a year. So I'm going to go back to a residency. I get kicked out of a residency because now I'm doing Ritalin and I'm even crazier. And I'm doing stuff like taking down my smoke alarm every night. When the neighbors were spying on me through the smoke alarm. It was just paranoia, and it was bad. I started off that program, too, the first couple months. "Oh, you're great. You're going to be the chief resident of this program. We think you have a lot of potential. Just promise us your past is behind you." "Yes, I absolutely promise you with 100% of my cells that I am done with this. I do not want to live like that again." And then in April of 2000 now, I'm getting kicked out of the third program. This time, not to complete the year, you know, but not to enter the premises of the hospital ever again. You know, here I am, just my residency director is telling me I have a problem, and I'm yelling at him, and "You say that I'm worse than so-and-so, and they're idiots, they don't know anything, and I know so much more than everybody else." I got that arrogance going on, too, now. That drug-fueled delusion. So when he fired me, and then later that night, the married woman I was dating dumped me, and I took up alcohol again. That was my bottom. Turns out my sister, who was living in Richmond, and I'm up in Reading, Pennsylvania, and I call her drunk. I hadn't had a drink in 9 months, but I'm still doing Ritalin the whole time. Now I'm drunk, and I called her just in a blackout, saying I'm bleeding with blood all over the place. Turns out she later said that she hadn't had a surrender at that moment, realized, my brother is dying. You know, I stepped on something. There was a bunch of blood. Cut my foot pretty good. Never did get stitches or anything, but there's a lot of blood all over the place. I was just pathetic. Another time in a series of times, my family had to come bail me out. You know, I got a medical degree. I got a medical license. I can legally practice medicine. I'm not a specialist, but that's okay. Maybe let's go do something. So I go live with mom and dad. This is 2000. I go work in prison. It's a good job for a drunk doc. Plenty of drunk docs working in prisons. I work in the Dillon Correctional Center. And I'm the doctor. And hadn't quite kicked the alcohol and the Ritalin. So one day the guard frisks me. He said, "What are all these pills in your pocket?" I said, "Oh, don't you worry about that. That's for personal consumption." Now, looking back on that, I'm smuggling controlled substances into a penitentiary, and I'm blatantly saying, "Don't worry, that's my personal consumption." I should still be locked up for that. I mean, I was committing crimes left and right. I didn't see them as crimes. I would get so high on this Ritalin, I would drive from Richmond up to Harrisonburg when I was working there, and through the, what's that windy road that goes all the way up to Elkton from Richmond. I would drive that with a nice little turbo Volkswagen with enough room on the dashboard to put a battery-operated keyboard. I would play this and drive the windy road. that's insane. Yeah, so that's my bottom in 2000, which is a full 2 years before I got sober. Nothing really happened in 2002. And I'm, you know, got fired from the Dillon job, got fired from the Harrisonburg job, got fired from everything. I had a job going out to Culpeper, doing life insurance physicals for $40 or something. I mean, that's really the bottom. That wasn't quite the bottom. Got fired from doing that. Then I'm doing disability exams, and finally the guy finds 50 undone disability. I went and did the physicals, but I couldn't do the paperwork for some reason. So I got 50 undone disability exams in the trunk of my car. Oh, I was not a good worker. You know what I just realized? That disability thing was 2 years sober. You know, for bad news for those of you who want to get perfect right away. Anyway, yeah, so I get sober. I go, I don't know what happened. Here's how I got sober. My mom and dad, you know, I'm living in their house the fourth or fifth time, right? And they basically say, they see me drinking every day, not obeying any rules. But that's not what's killing them. What's killing them is their son, who's got a collection of diplomas in his bedroom closet, is dysfunctional. My dad would sit me down and say stuff like, what kind of life are you living? You don't have any friends. You can't work. You're not married. You don't have a girlfriend. You don't have, frankly, a chance of getting a girlfriend. That can hurt. Yeah. And I said, well, you know, I used to say stuff like, well, Dad, you don't have any friends, and you drink, and blah, blah, blah. I have a job. I have a wife. You know, I didn't understand that he's trying to help me, you know. He was so gentle, and he was, but they reached the end of the rope, right? My mom and dad, after a while, they called me in. They called the psychiatrist who was giving me this Ritalin, and they said, our son is a Ritalin addict. The stupid psychiatrist said, no, there is no such thing. This is patient-doctor confidentiality. And he kept writing me this stuff. It was crazy. I would take 10 times the amount prescribed, you know, be done with it in a few days. It was crazy stuff. But what led me to my bottom was, the fact that I was pathetic, didn't have a life, didn't have a friend, couldn't look a grown adult in the eye, and was living off my mom and dad's. I mean, by this time, when the student loan people are saying, can you pay some money? And I'd say, I don't have any money. They'd say, well, can you pay $50 a month? I'd say, no. Can you pay $10 a month? I'd say, look, you don't understand. Every little bit of money I have is directly given to me. I don't have any money for the student loans. Nothing. That's not a way to live. So it's a struggle. One day at a time. I said, well, can I just live like this today? It's very much like being homeless, I guess. I don't know. I haven't been homeless. But I know I was not able to face life. But when they finally said for the millionth time, why don't you stop drinking? And the answer that came out of my mouth was, I can't. I consider that my bottom. Nothing happened. Just sort of the truth happened. I can't. So they said, well, we got a plan. We're going to take you over to the hospital, the detox. One of the hospitals has a detox. We'll take you there. So I went there. They were a little silly. I went in there. I didn't say I was alcoholic because I was a Ritalin addict. For some reason, I guess I'm willing to give up the Ritalin but not the alcohol. And so the psychiatrist there, they had a team of psychiatrists because they were like, oh, this is an interesting case. You'll never see one of these in your life. A Ritalin addict. I'm like, what are you guys, why is everybody saying there's no such thing as a Ritalin addict? I'm clearly addicted to this stuff. You should see how I use it. I take 10 pills, I crush them, I snort them up, and I keep doing that for 3 days until 300 pills are gone. That is an addict. I'm looking at the blind to see if the cops are coming. I'm hiding from the cops in the shower. The cops don't exist. That is an addict. And I do the same thing again. And if I'm fine for 5 days, and then I find a pill accidentally underneath the cushion in my car, oh, I got to look, see if there's another one for 4 hours. So they finally, one guy said, one psychiatrist of the group, so we've got good news and bad news for you. And bad news is really good news, but it's going to sound like bad news to you. And the good news is you don't have to live like this anymore. And the bad news is we think you're alcoholic and you can never drink again and have to do these certain things. Certain things were go to treatment. And I went for a 3-month program with a bunch of doctors and special people like me, because they put me on a bunch of special people. That was good for me to be around a bunch of other special people, because then I realized I'm not special. It became really annoying. People would raise their hand when I'm down in Mississippi in this rehab, and everybody would say, "My name's David, and I'm an alcoholic and a physician. And my name's Mike, and I'm an alcoholic and a physician." I'm like, what's the ego going on there? And somehow at one point it fell out of my mouth, "I'm an alcoholic and I'm just a garden variety drunk." And that's another phrase, I don't know exactly what that means, garden variety, but that's what I am, a garden variety alcoholic. And after 3 months in that rehab, I realized, actually the first day I was there, I called my brother, really mad at me, in fact, he still won't talk to me to this day. I called him, I said, "Look, there's three steps. I heard there's 12, I know you know there's 12, but there's only three that are important. And I've done them. I did them because I realized I had a problem. I came to believe that going to treatment would fix the problem. And I submitted to going to treatment. That means I made a decision to do something about it. So going to treatment has got me through the only three steps that matter. So I might as well just go home." And well, I stayed for 3 months. At the end of 3 months, I was scared to leave. Because I found that I'd been sober for 3 months. And I wanted to stay that way. So I re-upped for another 6 months in that program. Because the only sober people I ever met in my life were counselors in a rehab. And I wanted to be near those people no matter what it took. But at the end of 9 months, I'm realizing, which should be obvious to anybody, you can't stay in a treatment center forever. You're going to have to graduate. So I graduated and I came back to Mom and Dad's house where I lived for another year and a half, something like that. Sounds a little bit different, but not entirely different. I would say stuff like, "Well, we learned that you're sick too and you need Al-Anon." And that didn't go over well at all. My mom said, "Well, I put up with so much." At some level I realized that we had to go to family counseling, and the family counselor came up with the brilliant insight that if you want to get along with your parents better, move out of their house. Which seemed to be both, you know, it's just like a non-alcoholic complaining, "Why don't you just stop drinking?" You know, I see that that's the truth, but there's a component here that you don't understand. Like, I can't support myself, I can't get a job. I tried to get a job in the pizza place, they told me I was overqualified. I tried to get a residency again, and they said, "You failed three times, you can't come back. I can't get a job." So finally, I had to end up just starting my own practice. You know, my first job in medicine, in sobriety, was a year and a half sober, and what had happened was I tried everything to get a job. I threw myself in Alcoholics Anonymous. I know that that's the core. And I know I'd lost everything. I didn't have anything. I didn't have that car anymore. They repoed that. Went down in treatment along with my first big book, my $50,000 big book. And so I'm living with Mom and Dad, and I'm going to AA. It started out, you know, they're dropping me off a block away from the AA meeting. And I don't want to be 34 years old and dropped off at AA by my mom and dad. I hate this crap. And I'm going to AA meeting. I have glasses with one of the earpieces missing. And I'm just pathetic. And then I go, "Share. It's my chance to share. I just went to 9 months of treatment. And I tell you all about what recovery is all about." And I knew so much more than them because none of those AA people had the luxury of going to 9 months of treatment. I had so much education. I knew everything. Boy, I was glad to be told that I didn't know everything. You know, I went to treatment and I said, "You know, there's three parts to the four step." No, I didn't. I didn't know the three parts. There's resentment and fear. And then this girl goes, "And sex." I just spent 9 months in a treatment center. They didn't tell me there was a sex inventory. You know, because I just did the first three steps. Anyway, so I got plugged into AA. You know, for the first year and a half, I'm doing everything there is to be done. When you name something they tell you to do in AA, I was doing it, right? I got through the 12 steps. I was praying like crazy. I'd become to believe that I might as well pray. You know, can't lose. Can't be any harm from it. Praying to an imaginary God never hurt anybody. So I'm praying to an imaginary God. But then I'm starting to pray to this God that had kept me sober for 9 months. And I'm going to meetings. I'm required to go to these meetings to keep my medical license, and I'm going to 10 meetings a week. I have a home group. I'm committed there. I'm making the coffee. After I got through the 12 steps, I started sponsoring people. I mean, I was reading the big... you can't name a thing that you're supposed to do in AA that I wasn't doing. But I wasn't working yet. I'm like, well, how do I do AA in order to get a job? You know. So about a year and a half, here's what happened. I finally got a job in emergency care in Harrisonburg. It was the other emergency care. Anyway, I've worked at all of them. But, I was at the end of my rope, right? I talked to the guy who's Sam and my sponsor. By the time he was becoming my sponsor, about a year and a half, 2 years sober. And we're talking about how do we really practice these principles in all our affairs. Talking about you need to get a job. It's not for you, it's for the next guy. How are you going to have the miracle happen if you're not having it in your life? Be willing, do a sixth step. Be willing to have the miracle happen in your life. Seventh step, turn it over to God. I'm like, no, you're talking this AA stuff. I'm talking about real life. He's like, yeah. Stop going to so many meetings and start doing AA. I'm like, what? What are you talking about? I'm doing AA all the time. Yeah, you're going to meetings. You're visiting. You need to have this thing happen in your life, otherwise it means nothing. And I realized that I hadn't seen that in myself until then, but that's what was going on. I was getting burned out of AA. I was sick of the same people saying the same thing every week. And I wanted two things. I wanted to not drink, and I was willing to do anything to not drink. And that had happened so far. I hadn't had a drink, so I was willing to, but I was getting a little sick of it. But the other thing that I wanted was to have some success in life. I mean, how much church basements with grumpy guys can you take? And the truth is, I didn't know it, but I was coming up on getting sick of it. And he'd had that similar experience, so he knew exactly what I was going through. And I was about to get to the obvious realization that there's nothing to this AA thing. And I was going to drink, and then AA wouldn't have worked for its primary purpose, which is to keep me sober. Then AA works for nothing. And there's no point to doing all this silly spiritual exercise and stuff. The only answer was to move it forward in my own life. Stop going to so many AA meetings and start working on getting a job. And I worked on that for a few months, about 6 weeks, until I hit another bottom. Like, this is not working. I'm not working my head in the clouds. Now I'm working my feet on the ground, and that's not working either. And I just calling and calling and trying to get a job. And so I reached the bottom. And it's just called this guy who's been sober for 17 years. Just called him up and started crying, sobbing. You know, I'm done. I'll be a hairdresser. I'll be anything. Just let me have something in life. You know? And in the middle of that conversation, that phone call from Waynesboro Emergency Care. I said, well, how would you like a job? Crap. And I had to call him back and say, well, you know what we were just talking about 30 seconds ago? Forget it. God exists. And I really had some belief that that's how God works in my life. Is when I'm fully committed to it, I'm desperate. I'm at the end of my rope, and I'm trying my hardest. God can come in and take me over the finish line, you know, in a way that I never could by my human power. I couldn't create that phone call. I didn't apply to Waynesboro Emergency Care. Applied to every other place there is in the world. I had my radius around Richmond is getting bigger and bigger. I'm starting to apply to emergency rooms in North Carolina. Somehow that thing happened. I don't know how, and it's become very convenient for me to think of it as God, because that seems to be the way of it that works. Since then, having seen that as incorporating that in my life, having that being the first miracles, and to really say, well, I'm willing to put AA first, which is almost a decision point right there, right? Because I could have realized, I'm going to put myself into my career now that I have one. No, I put myself into AA even more, because that's what made the career happen. And so AA is going to be the foundation no matter what. I had this huge crush on this girl a few years later, and I told my sponsor, well, I'm going to miss an AA meeting about 4 months from now. The home group night, I miss a home group meeting. Because I got to go to her concert. So, well, think about that. I ended up not going to the concert. And that is weird. That is backwards thinking. You know, it turns out it worked even better. I told her, I can't go to your concert because I didn't tell you I was a music major in college. I played the French horn, and one of my decisions was I was going to be a musician or a doctor. And so, but now I'm taking lessons again at, you know, 35 years old, whatever. And I'm taking lessons with this woman. She's the first chair in the Roanoke Symphony, or one of those symphonies. Harrisonburg. Anyway, I really like her. And she says, "Oh, you can't come to my concert because you have an AA meeting? How about if I give you a special dress? I'll do the dress rehearsal just for you." That's kind of weird. That's amazing. That's better than if I had gone to the concert and been one of 4,000 people in the audience. You know, that's a silly example of, you know, if we ever want to do something that's the result of our success that we got as a result of AA, maybe we got to do AA instead, and that thing that's just an offshoot from AA will be even better. If you want something badly enough, don't take it from God, but give it to God. That kind of idea. So, just fast forward a little bit. Now, we had to start our own home group, my sponsor and I and some other guys. And the reason we did that is because, like Sam was saying, we really wanted to have and the model like, you know, my grand sponsor has in North Carolina. The all three legs of that triangle need to be there. I'm fully committed to doing this. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just following my sponsor. I haven't done anything in AA, but I've taken direction. I've done that. It's explicit direction. Sponsoring guys and doing all the things there are to do in AA. But we got to take it to the next level, and that means we got to, in unity, have service, and that service is providing recovery. In other words, those three interlocked legs of that triangle are completely codependent upon each other. So if we're not working as a team to do service, then we're not really doing it. I mean, I was in a group where some of the members were really active in service, but the group as a group was not. So, that idea of stop going to so many meetings and start doing AA. Well, what do you mean by that? Well, let's find out. So the things that we do, you know, like I said, as a group, we have a commitment in the, just give you a little rundown, because Sam gives you part of a rundown. We have three commitments in the local jail. So the Richmond City Jail, the Powhatan Prison, we have two commitments there. And the Richmond City Jail is just a weekly thing. We take turns, we rotate, so no one gets burned out. It's the group's commitment, not an individual commitment. So that thing's been going on. But it's an informational session. It's kind of like what we do at the local detox, where I was a resident for 3 days. It's an informational thing for the newcomer. In the prison, we're starting a home group. We've got guys there, they're going to be there for a long time. They need to have a home group of Alcoholics Anonymous where they can go through the steps and live, because they're going to, that's their home. So we started a home group there. Well, recently we just voted. We have about 9 guys that we've taken through our 12-step workshop that are, not all of them are just through the workshop. We've got 9 guys right now who are just in a position to really take the message to somebody else. They're at a decision point right now, or not, a turning point. They can either take the message to someone else or they can flounder. So why don't we provide a solution to those guys? Well, one of the things we're doing is we're going to look for another prison now. We're going to find another prison commitment. So that's the corrections thing. We'll snuck in a little bit of our newcomers committee too. Help the newcomers. Then the other committees we have are public information. You know, there's little sound bites, these little PSAs that GSO puts out, and they expect each area to contact their local radio stations and try to put those things on the radio. So we did that in Richmond, and other groups went along. That's easy. We could do that. And so there's several radio stations now. It's easy. I mean, the GSO says, here they are. Just put them on your local radio station. So we did that. And we made our own little video. Billy's the star of it. Really, really. He's a 30-minute video. It took us 2 years to produce. And a story of recovery. It's wow. Yeah, he's in that thing. That's great. And we got a website, and you guys have all that stuff, phone number. It's just a way of getting public information out there. It's a little funny. I went to the inner group and I said, look, we have a website and a phone number. We'd like you to publish, I don't know if you call your directory the where and when, our meeting directory. Publish our everybody's, if they have one, a website and phone number and the where and when. It was a funny little discussion we had. We ended up losing that. I couldn't understand what the motivation was, but apparently some of the groups thought that we were promoting ourselves by having our phone number and the website published in the where and when. But you know, the truth is that's not true. Nobody's promoting anything. We're just trying to help you know, as many alcoholics know that there is a solution as possible. So it's kind of like, wow, I'm not just trying to help the newcomer. I'm trying to get along with other drunks. Sometimes there's opinions. And so that's like the level of sobriety where I might be right, but if I'm going to ram my opinion down someone's throat, I'm wrong. I really have to, you know, work these traditions, which are about getting along with other people in my own life. So I figured out how to incorporate those steps in my life and figuring out how to incorporate those traditions and looking at the concepts now where, you know, the right of decision, like if I'm, you know, if I'm elected to office, I get to exercise my duty as that officer without being micromanaged by the committee over there, you know. So recovery has looked like an amazing thing for our home group. It's really grown amazingly. I didn't get through the committees. We have a cooperation with the professional committee, which is our last committee, and we deal with the professionals. So one of the things we do is we have the local nursing students that go to the Medical College of Virginia, and any nursing students going to get a nursing degree at that university is going to come through our home group, sort of visit, just to see a speaker meeting, to see a drunk, and then we talk to them a little about how they're integral. And if they're in a healing profession, they're going to run into a lot of drunks in the course of their profession, and what they can do to help an alcoholic. Now that they've seen that there really is a solution, we've got a room full of sober alcoholics, you know, seeing is believing. And talk to doctors. We're trying to get a program up with the residents up there in the medical college. Get some other projects with that. So that's what that looks like with the growing home group as a result of successes in our own lives and successes that we've had and people feeling really at home. And like not just sharing someone's opinion at a meeting, which is I was starting to get annoyed at about a year and a half, 2 years sober. Like, I'm sick of hearing your opinion. Let's get to work. That's the work. I really think that the fifth tradition, our primary purpose to help another alcoholic, it has to be operative. And we have to have a way of doing that. I can't do that alone, or I'll burn out, and I won't even carry it. But we have the message of our whole home group. This is the way we do it. Each home group has their own flavor. That's the fourth tradition. But we get to do it our own way, and that's how we do it. And that's attractive, because people are coming, they're staying, and then they're helping others. And they're making that transition from, I want to be helped, to, I want to continue to help others. And my own life is just, it's been incredible. I mean, about 4 years ago, my success story was I finally bought a house, but that's an old story. I did that 4 years ago. I've got a girlfriend now for the past 3 years, and yeah, she's beautiful, but you know, the question now is this the woman I want to be with, or is it not? And it's a luxury problems, I tell you, for someone who wasn't able to, you know. I'm probably the only physician, well, I'm the only one I ever heard of. Never did, you know, I did those 3 years of residency, or 2 years and 7 months, or whatever it was. Didn't quite finish. I'm the only, you know, general practitioner, which is a euphemism for dropout. It's got a successful practice. I do. I have a practice that's very successful. I ended up doing the nursing home thing, and I stumbled into it. I didn't decide to do that, but I found an opportunity out of desperation. I needed a job badly. I walked into a couple nursing homes. And now I have a practice. I have hundreds of patients. I have a nurse practitioner. I have another physician working for me. I have a biller, a secretary, and a fax machine. You know, and I have a successful practice and make a lot of money. And my sponsor was telling my grand sponsor, they're talking about me. I heard about it because my sponsor was telling me. So, he's the only guy I know of that's, you know, GP is making that much money. And I said, well, do you tell him about the part where I'm not satisfied with that? He said, I really want to go back. Go back to the Massey Cancer Center and become a specialist. That's what I wanted to do. I mean, a few years ago, my sponsor was joking, because he works there, he's a professor too, got his, some of you know Mark, he got his job back, became an anesthesiologist, and those guys don't get their job back, so he had a miracle too. He was joking with me, he said, I was talking down there in your department, they said they want you back, and he was just kidding, but a little tear came from my cheek, and I'm like, yeah, if you were only telling the truth, if I really could get that back. And so we've been working on that a few years now. And another guy in our home group, Josh, he was just having the same kind of experience. He was he came to our home group from California about 11 years sober. He was struggling in sobriety, because that happens. And then he found our home group, and he's doing better. And he was struggling to get into a residency. He just got in as a result of some spiritual exercises, as a result of some influence Mark had talking to the residency directors and things like that. And an absolute miracle. Things like that, when we want the miracle to happen, they can, but not on our terms, not in any way for our own sake. Like I was saying, if I was satisfied by making, because I don't make a lot of money. I make a lot of money, but it's all going towards those student loans and those debts. It's nine stuff. I don't keep a lot of it at all. I'm pretty poor, actually. Right? And I'm sure that the moment I'm done with that nine step, probably that money source will dry up. But I'll be free. I'll be willing to make that. I'll be able. I'm already willing. I'll be able to make that decision now that I can afford. Because I have to pay this money, right? But when it's paid off, I'll be able to make a free man's decision. Do I want to do medicine at all? I think the answer will be yes, but I'll have the luxury of looking at it. Do I want to do that? Do I want to be a musician? I wanted to be a musician. When I was 1.5 years sober, I said, that was supposed to be a professional musician, But so I'll be free, and I'm probably just about a year away from doing that, financially. I don't know how that works in my life, but see, when I can get up to the podium and say, I'm a real alcoholic. Not that I'm any different than any other garden variety alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic. And my life is, not only have I been free from the obsession to drink since I was 11 months sober, but I've had a way of getting into life and able to keep in AA and help other people without leaving it and just grow in helping others. When I'm able to say that at the podium and tell the truth, then maybe I can offer some hope to someone who's ready. If your problem is, I'm an alcoholic, but you don't understand, my life is completely a wreck. I've destroyed it. Just remember what the book says, that many of us could have gotten sober earlier, but we didn't have a real need to. And by the time we had a real need to get sober, it was like it was too late. Our lives were a complete wreck. And the only way out, like Carl Jung said, right, is there is an exception every now and again, and we need to find that spiritual awakening. All that means to me is that miracle. That if not only miracle A, have I not had a compulsion to drink, but miracle B, all those things, maybe be willing to be sober that I didn't have a wife or a house or a job or a career, any of that stuff that makes life really nice, livable. I have those things too. Now I know people that are alcoholic. They have all those things. We've all heard of millionaires who are just, they have everything. They're supposed to have everything in life. Life is beautiful, but yet they're miserable. So now I know that that's not going to be my solution. I don't want to search after the dollar or the most beautiful woman or none of that stuff's going to matter. All that stuff has to be a gift, right? As a result of living in the miracle, living the dream. So, stuff sounds amazing to me. I catch myself saying, I saw God, and I say, oh, as you understand God, because I don't want to offend you by using the word God. Or I'll say the word miracle. When I mean miracle, what I mean is that I haven't had a drink and my life is turned around. But no, I literally mean God, and I literally mean miracle. And once we believe that really happens, and the solution is further surrender. If I got a new problem, which is just a luxury because I couldn't deal with that problem when I'm drinking, now I got a new problem. Surrender. Keep moving. Progress rather than perfection. None of us will ever be perfect. My character defects are there. I saw that in my fourth and fifth step. That doesn't mean that they're gone. It just means that, that's what's impeding me from where I want to go. So, I would say, in terms of sobriety, I don't know. I know what my life will look like at 16 years because I know what my sponsor's life looks like. I know what life will look like at 54 years because I know what my grandsponsor's life looks like. Now that's the superficialities are totally different, right? Absolutely incompatible lives. But I know what life is like for for a newcomer at 1 year. I know what life is like for 2 years. When someone says, when will life get good? I'll say, well, in my experience, I finally reached that high water mark of my life, about 4 years sober. Ever since then, it's gotten better. The best day of my life. Every day has been better than the previous day. I became happy and satisfied with the way things are at about 4 years. That means not that I'll be satisfied if my life is the same way tomorrow as it is today. I'll not be satisfied with that. But I'm happy with today the way it is today. And I've been that way since I was about 4 years sober. So I know that it'll continue to get better and better. And I can offer that. That's what 12-step work really is. It's not giving advice. It's giving experience. I know exactly what that is like. I know what freedom from that is. I know the temptation to succumb to the delusion that I can just, turn it all in and go take my career and, refund my chips or whatever the analogy is. And I know I can't do that, right? Why would I stay in AA for 9 years of sobriety? Well, because A, I haven't gotten to the point where I'm happy enough yet. I still want some stuff in life. And B, I know that if I do that, I'll be miserable and drunk instantly. I know that. And so, well, you said to stop talking when I ran out of stuff. So I'll do that.